Tavis Smiley, and I am pleased to have you hanging out with us today on this program, especially in this hour. It's been an amazing program so far. Two great conversations with Mark Lamont Hill in our first hour, William Darity, Duke economist, in our second hour, and I am thrilled now to be in dialogue for the hour with Brianna Joy Gray as we talk politics with the former press secretary for Bernie Sanders, now host of the Bad Faith podcast and co-host of the Hill's program Rising. I love that program. It's the always outspoken and never shy to speak her truth, Brianna Joy Gray, who joins us right now. Brianna, how are you today?
I'm doing very well, thank you, especially after that gangster white wall intro. It's one of my favorite songs.
Did you tell Miles to play that? He just happened to do that.
I did not. That's just some kind of serendipity that we're experiencing on this solar day.
I love serendipity. I'm all for serendipity. For those who may not have heard our first hour today, let me just repeat what I said then, because I want to get Brianna Joy's take on this in just a second here. So I announced in our first hour today, it will be in the news tomorrow. But because you're special, I'm telling you today, don't tell nobody, because it's not out until tomorrow. So the official announcement goes out to the media tomorrow. But Dr. Cornel West, who Brianna Joy Gray has interviewed a number of times, I've seen him on her program, Rising. Noted scholar, of course, independent candidate for president, will announce his vice presidential running mate exclusively on this program Wednesday, April the 10th, during our first hour. So just about 48 hours from now, in the first hour of this program, Dr. West will announce on this program exclusively his running mate for this campaign, and they will both join us Wednesday. He's bringing the running mate with him. So we will spend the first hour of Wednesday's program talking to Dr. West, and whoever this running mate will be announced to the world on Wednesday. Look forward to the first hour of that program on Wednesday. So, Brianna Joy Gray, you see why I raise that, because, as I mentioned a moment ago, I've seen you on more than one occasion in conversation with my dear friend and brother Cornel West about this campaign. So let me ask you the same question I asked Mark Lamont Hill in our first hour, and that is, without knowing who his selection is, what kind of person in a campaign like this? You ran, you were there helping to run Bernie Sanders' campaign. In a moment like this, an election like this, in a campaign like this, what kind of person do you think Cornel West should be considering as his running mate?
It's interesting, right? Because most of the time when we're thinking about this within the realm of establishment politics, the question is, in what ways can the VP pick shore up certain deficiencies in the primary, in the top of the ticket candidate, right? So it's, you know, is there a swing state that is in contention where if you get a senator or a representative from that state could potentially turn out more votes because of more name recognition in that state? Is there an issue with a candidate being under-experienced where you want somebody who knows the ropes? Is there an issue where the candidate is older and you want a younger candidate? Are people looking for a certain amount of kind of a diversity on the ticket, a gender diversity, racial diversity, et cetera? But sometimes I feel like when we're talking about outside insurgent candidates, the concerns are less about sort of identity or kind of the logistics of can I win the state or the other, largely because I think as much as I personally am rooting for Dr. West and would love to see him as president of the United States of America, there's a certain understanding that it's a long shot. So if the value of the campaign is largely about the messaging, then the core concern is whether or not the VP really sticks the landing in terms of the ideals that are being espoused by the candidate, whether they can bring more attention to the candidacy, given how the establishment media tends to have a blackout on challengers to the president. And I'd be really interested to see if a candidate can bring more kind of positive attention to the race, and also whether or not there's someone who is not going to upset the progressive base that he has built for himself by being perhaps maybe too establishment, more to his right.
Those are all interesting considerations. I want to unpack a few of those considerations with Brianna Joy Gray when we come forward. Yeah, there's a lot to talk to her about. I'm just thinking as I'm talking. All right, I'm Tavis Smiley. She's Brianna Joy Gray. More when we come forward. Stay with us.
This is getting good.
Yeah, man.
Tavis Smiley continues when we come forward. honesty than you can handle.
More empowerment than you can imagine.
You're tuned in to Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley and Breonna Joy Gray, who is the host of the Bad Faith Podcast and co-host of the HEAL program, Rising, which I watch as often as I can. I love the work that you and her co-host do on that program. But just a huge Breonna Joy Gray fan am I, and delighted to have her back on this program. Let me dispense of this right now, Breonna Joy Gray. I teased Mark Lamont Hill in the first hour, and I said to him, I said, well, Mark, I assume since you're a guest on my program live today, that you're not going to walk up in this studio on Wednesday and surprise me as Cornel West running mate. I assume I can take you off the list, and we had a good chuckle about that, and he played coy for a while, but eventually acknowledged that he is not the running mate with Cornel West, but he's anxious to find out who is on Wednesday on this program again in our first hour. So you see where I'm going. Let me just ask you point blank, as I'm reading a bunch of people sending me messages and posting right now about this conversation. Somebody says, Tavis, are you going to ask Breonna Joy Gray if she is Dr. West's choice? She'd actually be great. Hashtag BJG 2024. I love that. Hashtag BJG 2024. So Breonna Joy Gray, let me just ask you point blank. I'm just trying to cut down my list between now and Wednesday. Are you the running mate with Cornel West?
I don't want to spoil it, but I'm afraid I'm not. I know they could be coy like Mark and draw it out a little bit longer,
yeah.
But I'm not that good a showman. No, I mean, it would be an honor to be considered to run along someone who I hold in as much esteem as I do Dr. West. But no,
yeah.
I will not be his running mate in 2024.
Okay. Then again, maybe he hasn't made that choice yet. He just told me to hold Wednesday because he's about to make the ask. You may get a phone call from Cornel West later today, for all I know.
Let me see if I have any unread emails in my inbox.
All that said, tell me why, since we're talking about it, I'm just curious, and we'll move toward what you call the blackout of any candidate running against President Biden. I like that phrase, the blackout. So we'll get your take on this third party thing in just a moment here. But tell me why you've been, you know, in this conversation and in others, but just in this dialogue, you've been rather effusive about your praise of Cornel West. Why do you like him as a candidate in this race?
Because he's a principled person who's been living by his principles loudly and at great personal expense for decades and decades. I mean, this was part of what the appeal was, I think, for a lot of folks with Bernie Sanders. We live in a political climate where people pop up every 2 to 4 years saying that they understand what's wrong with America, that they feel your pain, that they are willing to agree with you on any number of points about how things need to change and how the people on the inside aren't paying enough attention to the people on the ground. And then they get into office and they completely change their tune. And the result of that has been that people are increasingly disaffected. They are less engaged with politics, understandably so, because they've seen it not really pay off for them. There was that 2014 Princeton study that showed that there is no relationship between what the people want and what legislators are willing to enact. So when you have someone like Bernie, who has been inside all that time and had such a esteemed record for fighting for working class people, willing to take a lot of flack from his own caucus, to be an independent in Congress for all of that time. When you have someone like Cornel West, who has been punished professionally for standing up for the rights of Palestinians, for instance, and basically had these very elite institutions turn their backs on him and all of his scholarship, you know, that really is a confidence builder, I think, for people. And I'll speak for myself as a confidence builder for myself, that if he were to be successful, then we would get the same Cornel West we know and love for all of these years in the White House.
Mm-hmm. No, I hear that, and I concur with that. I mean, he is, having known him for 30 some years, he is as advertised, that I can guarantee you. He is as advertised, and he is consistent. No matter what one thinks of him, he's consistent in his views and his beliefs. And he's a long distance runner. I'll put it that way. He is a long distance runner. And I take your point. Let me pivot now to speaking of Dr. West, and he's not the only independent candidate. Robert Kennedy Jr. is out there. He's already announced his running mate. Jill Stein is out there. There are others. Donald Trump, of course, has not yet announced his running mate. We'll talk about that perhaps. But to this point you made earlier, Breonna Joy Gray, about this blackout, as you put it, this blackout of challenges to the president. I don't need to color this question much more. I'll just follow you. Unpack for me your read of this blackout of candidates to the president and the way that the Democratic Party and the Biden campaign has been acting or reacting to these independents.
Well, you hear them say it. You heard them say it explicitly during what should have been a primary season, but which obviously was not one. I believe my predecessor on the Bernie campaign from 2016, Sheldon Herschel, Simone Sanders, quote, "There will be no primary." It was said very matter-of-factly. And I do understand that Biden is an incumbent. It's not completely unusual for the Democratic Party to say, we're not going to entertain other candidates. We're going to be behind the incumbent. But it's a very different question for what the news media is willing to do in this scenario. Is the news media going to listen to what is clearly a significant appetite from the American people for an alternative when you have two historically unpopular candidates in a historically unpopular rematch? I mean, when I say historically unpopular, that's not just me kind of casting aspersions. Joe Biden and Donald Trump both are historically unpopular when you look at their favorability polls. Nobody wants this rematch. And for months now, it's been clear that a majority of Democrats think that Biden is too old to run. And the crisis in Gaza has only exacerbated people's frustrations, as the overwhelming majority of Democratic voters think there should be a permanent ceasefire and disagree with the severity of the siege and how it's been enacted with the support of Joe Biden, who went and gave a bear hug to Bibi Netanyahu and all of his right-wing policies. That being said, instead of having a media which listens to the people and provides a platform for alternative candidates so they can make an informed choice as to what their options are at the ballot box, there's a complete shutdown, and the mainstream liberal media, CNN and MSNBC, are willing to give more time to someone like, say, RFK Jr., who I think expresses some overlap with what left values are, but is very, very far from them in other respects, because they perceive him to be damaging to Donald Trump. To the extent that he's perceived to be damaging to the Democratic Party, they'll shut him out too. And of course, you'll hear much more from Republicans. You'll see more Republicans on their panels, et cetera, than you'll ever see from people who represent the left flank of the Democratic Party or people outside of the Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party is insufficiently left.
Yep. I've asked this question of others, but not of you, certainly not of late, given all the machinations that we're experiencing and watching every day regarding this campaign. But what is your view of this notion that RFK Jr. and Cornel West and Jill Stein and others are running at the wrong time? This is not the time that Donald Trump, you know the line, represents an existential threat to our democracy. Indeed, he does. But this is the wrong time for anybody to be running a third-party campaign.
The argument that Donald Trump presents an existential threat is weakened significantly by the reality that under Biden's watch, and again, with his blessing, we have seen some estimates as high as 40,000 people killed in Gaza by our ally, Israel, while we send them $3.8 billion in aid, and while Joe Biden has gone around Congress to send additional weapons packages that aren't in large enough amounts to require congressional approval, slipping them constructively under the radar, and of course agitating for more money to be spent since, and saying that he will not condition aid on Israel complying with its humanitarian obligations. It has given it carte blanche. He has given the country carte blanche to do what they will. And so when you look at all of the genuinely horrible things that that Trump did and that he has pledged to do, and you look at the balance sheet of the harms that we've now seen Biden has willing to do, and the Trump policies he's been willing to maintain and exacerbate, including some of the worst aspects of the border policy, cutting into undermining our asylum laws for people who have legitimate asylum claims, this fight that's happening at the Supreme Court over whether or not federal jurisdiction is going to be able to may remain supreme is a different sort of issue. But the point being that a lot of the things that were argued, people argued made Trump the worst president of all time and an existential threat, including his border policy, kids in cages, et cetera, have been continued by the Biden administration. So I'm genuinely asking, you know, what is the ground that Biden can stand on now to say that the world would be constructively better? I think there's a really strong argument that if Donald Trump were doing some of these horrible things, that at very least there would be a protest movement that was in the mainstream against him. And right now what we're seeing is a lot of people who have been basically apologizing for Biden for months now, saying that his policy toward Gaza in particular must be good because he's a Democrat and he's a good guy. And now, only now that we have this policy shift after the seven aid workers with the Jose Andreas food kitchen suppliers were murdered by an IDF drone a week ago, do we have this rhetorical shift that really validates what leftists have been saying for a really long time, which is that Biden had the power to do more and was choosing not to.
Let me, I was just talking in my last hour to Duke economist William Darity about why President Biden is not getting credit for these 39 months consecutive of strong economic growth. The jobs numbers are pretty good for 39 straight months. It's been growing. And I asked him as an economist why he thinks the president isn't getting credit for that. He gave his answer. The point I'm pushing toward with you is not so much that, but to underscore that there are things that Joe Biden, I believe, has done for which he's not getting credit. On the other hand, on this issue of Israel and Hamas that you're unpacking for us right about now, there is a clear, and I'm not naive in saying this or asking you about it, there is a clear distinction between his words and his deeds. This is not something that you got to spend a lot of time researching. You can just watch him every day. He is saying one thing, he's doing another. There is a clear divide. I'm not trying to demonize the president. I'm calling balls and strikes here. He's saying one thing and he's doing another. I'm not even critiquing the policy right now. I'll allow you to do that. You're the guest. I'm just pointing out, again, he's saying one thing, he's doing something else. In real time, how do I read that disconnect? How do I read that divide, that gulf between his words and his deeds?
Yeah, it's really confusing. He did that interview, I believe, on MSNBC maybe a month or so ago, where he said in the same breath, there are red lines for Israel. And then in later in the sentence, but I will not be conditioning aid. There's nothing that's going to stop me from sending aid to Israel, which, you know, if I have a child and say, you know, you're not going to get dessert unless you, you know, clean your room beforehand. But also, no matter what you do with your tidiness of your room, I'm going to give you dessert. It doesn't take rocket science to understand how, you know, what is my real meaning there? You know, what am I really willing to do to enforce my own policy? How serious should you take my words and my policy there? This has been a problem with, I would argue, Democrats. Of course, with Republicans, but I'm not really concerned with them. We all kind of know what the score is there. And this is part of that goes back to your question about why third parties are so important. Democrats are extremely good at presenting themselves as the better alternative. And they manage to coast on being the better alternative, even when there is such an enormous gap between what they are willing to do and what their constituents want them to do. And I feel very strongly that until voters stop rewarding Democrats for doing the bare minimum of being better than what is being described as a fascistic, democracy-undermined party in the Republicans, that unless they're willing to do something better than, more than just being better than the devil, as they describe them, then they should not be rewarded with our vote. And that's where it's why it's so important to have a third party sort of a resting place, an alternative place where you can go to the ballot, show that you're engaged in the system, and cast your vote for a different set of policies. So the Democrats can say, oh, these are people who are willing to vote. These are people who are engaged in the system, but they're willing to vote for Medicare for all. They're willing to vote for an end to foreign interventionism. They're willing to vote for a higher minimum wage. Right, they're willing to vote for dental being included as part of their health care coverage. Basic reforms that largely Americans agree on.
I guess my question is whether or not this dichotomy, this distinction, this difference between his words and his deeds is to be defined as, how about I put this, as deceitful and duplicitous, or is to be defined as the president doing statecraft, I mean, it could be duplicitous. It could be statecraft. Whoa. You tell me.
I mean, I kind of feel like those are the same things to me in some ways, right? Like, Biden is not, I mean, what is statecraft? I don't know, the state getting crafty about pulling the wool over your eyes. I mean, look, I'm not going to speak to what's in Joe Biden's heart. I don't know what's in that man's heart.
Right.
But I know that he knows. He's looking at these polls and seeing that his voters, overall majorities of Americans, like 80% of Democrats, want there to be a permanent ceasefire. And he knows that for reasons that has been, you know, that exists long before his administration in this campaign, that the United States has made a commitment for military, strategic, geopolitical, democracy building, whatever you want to call it, whatever euphemisms you want to call it, reasons for maintaining this Israeli state that can be the democracy in the Middle East, quote unquote, from which we can launch our foreign affairs. And it is willing to maintain that relationship without conditions, even if it means that he might very well lose this entire election over it to this man that they're telling us is going to end democracy as we know it. So the question is it really the voter's fault? If Biden has made that deal with the devil, if Biden has made that bargain and said, it matters more to me to maintain this relationship with Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu and the people who live there who are not citizens and not taxpayers of the United States of America, over listening to what my citizens say we should be doing with our money, billions of money dollars going out of the door to Israel, so they can, according to the ICJ, do what has been described as a plausible genocide in Gaza. If he's willing to make that decision, why should we be asking voters not to take him up on his offer, not to do the completely predictable thing, which is to either stay home and vote or vote for an alternative candidate who isn't thumbing his nose at them?
Mm. This is getting good, as we say around here. When we come forward with Breonna Joy Gray, there are other issues I want to cover with her. I want to talk about this, speaking of Joe Biden, this uncommitted movement. There are folk in primaries, to the extent we had a primary season, given what Breonna Joy Gray said earlier, there really hasn't really been a primary season. This thing has been a fait accompli since day one, it seems. But I want to talk about this uncommitted movement. I want to talk about young voters. I want to get her take on black voters and our options this time around. I got a question specifically for her about Kamala Harris being the new Willie Horton, as I see it. A great deal more to cover with Breonna Joy Gray when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
More of Tavis Smiley when we come forward.
Paid for by government.com.
Helping to make you the most knowledgeable person in your circle of friends. This is Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley and Breonna Joy Gray, who is the former senior politics editor at The Intercept, former national press secretary for Bernie Sanders in 2020, and now the host of the Bad Faith podcast and co-host of a brilliant program called Rising. It is the Hills program that I tune into as often as I can. To be downloaded with insights that I am willing to wrestle with, because Breonna Joy Gray always makes me think when I engage her, and I'm glad to have her on this program. Let me talk about these uncommitted. We saw what happened in Michigan and beyond, but I'm wondering, as a strategy, as a political strategy, what you make of this uncommitted movement.
I think it is one of the smartest and most successful movements of this nature I've seen in a really long time. The argument against doing things like this, about having quote-unquote protest votes in the past, has been that if you do this, this is what they tell the left, if you do this, you're going to get blamed for Trump or whatever the Republican nominee is, their ultimate victory. And it won't actually advance your goals and interests. It'll just cause you to be reviled among Democrats, sort of what we might call the Bernie bro phenomenon, even though back in 2016, more Bernie Sanders for primary voters fell in line and voted for Hillary Clinton than Hillary Clinton primary voters fell in line and voted for Barack Obama back in 2008. But that's a different story. So that's the argument, right? Don't do it because you're going to be the villain in it when they tell the story back in history. But what they're doing with uncommitted is, one, by placing it during the primary process, they're really exposing the extent to which the primaries are for exactly this sort of thing. There is no general election risk happening here. It's an opportunity for voters to make it known that there are conditions to their vote, that the ultimate nominee can choose to acquiesce to listen to the voters, and to redeem themselves before the general election time comes around. And if they don't, we know exactly what votes Biden could have gotten in the general had he been a different kind of candidate. And the blame is more rightly, I think, put on him as to why he didn't listen to the public on an overwhelmingly popular agenda item, in this case, ending the siege on Gaza, when he could have done that to defeat Trump. So specifically, if you want to talk numbers, I'm happy to get into that as well, because their success is not just limited, of course, to Michigan.
Make the case with the numbers. Go ahead.
So most recently, I think most significantly, is the state of Wisconsin, where they got about 40 uncommitted, it was called something different there, but they got about 47,000 votes. Now remember that Joe Biden narrowly beat Donald Trump in Wisconsin in 2020 by about half as many votes. And similarly, back in 2016, Hillary Clinton lost Wisconsin to Donald Trump by, again, about half as many people as voted uncommitted last week or whatever it was. That means that twice as many voters as has determined the outcome of the state in the last two election cycles is saying that they're withholding their votes for the primary candidate, for Joe Biden, in order to register discontent with how he's handling this crisis. And so the real question is Biden going to listen? And if he doesn't, are the Democrats going to be able to turn around and effectively blame those voters on his loss when Joe Biden had this opportunity months in advance to simply correct course?
I'm glad you made that last point. You've made it a couple of times now, and I want to come to that because on my home station, this program is syndicated across the country and heard in markets from California to the Carolinas. But here in L.A., where I'm based, on my home station, I did an editorial that we ran a few weeks ago. Ran it for a while, and the commentary was essentially asking the question, whose fault is it? Whose fault is it? And I played an old school song, an old school song from the Blind Boys of Alabama. And the lyrics are, if I die today and my soul be lost, ain't nobody's fault but mine. And so I played this Blind Boy song, and I asked in the commentary, in the editorial, if Joe Biden loses this election, whose fault is it? And I laid out all of these things that you just laid out, that we're reading, that we're watching. I delved into the data points, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The polls, the surveys, the studies. And I asked the question, if Joe Biden loses this race, whose fault is it? I think I hear already in your prior response what you think the answer to that question is. But I want to probe a little bit more to get a sense on the front side of this, and certainly I pray that Donald Trump is not the next president of the United States. But the day after, when the media starts doing its post-mortem, who are they going to blame for this loss? Will they blame Joe Biden? And if not, who else? Who are they going to blame?
Well, certainly they're going to blame progressives. I mean, how many cycles do we have to go through before we know that that's the case? You still hear Carville types melting down about the idea that Bernie bros did it. Sometimes you'll get some relief as a Bernie bro and they'll start to blame Russia. But at no point is there ever an accounting of whether Hillary Clinton could have treated some of the criticisms she was getting in 2016 more seriously, from people who were criminal justice reform advocates who were frustrated by her position, her statements around super predators, or her husband's policies with respect to the war on crime or defunding welfare or any of those kinds of things. Every criticism of her at the time was characterized as rooted in sexism or some kind of personal animus, which was certainly true of some people, but wasn't true of, I think, a lot of people in the Democratic Party base. Cut forward to 2020, I think Biden was largely saved by the fact that we were in the middle of a pandemic and people distrusted Donald Trump's ability to shepherd us out of it. But that is, like it or not, and sort of in the rear view mirror of people's minds. And they're asking themselves the question as to whether or not the Democratic Party has reckoned with its prior failures. Joe Biden seems to be, or the Democratic Party seems to be, again, saying none of these substantive criticisms are real. They're just mad about his age. They're not giving him enough credit for the economy. These are people who can't be satisfied, so they shouldn't be listened to. But they are ignoring some big ticket items. And I think, namely, Gaza is having a really huge effect in this election that I think the Biden administration didn't anticipate. They thought it was going to die out and be over, and that by election season, people weren't going to be paying attention anymore. But the death tolls could frankly be twice as high as they are now because of widespread disease and famine by the time we get to election day. And I don't know that Joe Biden wants to be looking down the barrel of having blood on his hands for 50,000, 60,000 people dead in Gaza when he has so late in the game switched course on the willingness to put any pressure on Netanyahu at all. Mm-hmm. So the question was, who's going to be blamed? They're going to blame the left, but the question is whether or not the media framing will be successful when so many people, you know, 83% of Democrats want there to be an immediate ceasefire, when everybody knows that this is not some fringe position. Just like Medicare for All is not some fringe position. Mm-hmm. 80%+ of Democrats support that as well. Can the media rightly convince us that we aren't in the majority and that it's the legislators who are wrong, as they've done in the past? I mean, that remains to be seen.
Yeah. When we come forward, let's talk about young voters. Now that we talk about the uncommitted, let's talk about these young voters. Let's talk about black voters as she sees them in terms of their options this time around, and all the articles written about the fact that the president's black numbers are soft and not getting stronger as quickly as they need to for him to pull this off in November. And then let's talk about Kamala Harris. We'll do all that with Breonna Joy Gray when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
You're listening to Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley.
Ranked number 45 on the Heavy 100 list of the 100 most important radio talk show hosts in America. Made fresh daily in the Mert Park,
Los Angeles, California.
You're listening to Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley and Breonna Joy Gray. If you have not heard this commercial, take a listen.
I guess I should clear my mind here a little bit.
We can all see Joe Biden's weakness. If Biden wins, can he even survive till 2029? The real question is, can we? Make America Great Again, Inc. is responsible for the content of this advertising.
That laughter that you hear in that ad is the voice, the laughter of one Kamala Harris. We've all seen her do this sort of laugh thing when she's in interviews and ask her a question, and she sort of goes into this sort of laugh thing to buy herself some time to respond. And so they've made effective use of that in this ad. My question in playing this ad, Breonna Joy Gray, is to simply ask whether or not, to your mind, because certainly it is the case in my mind, whatever one thinks of Kamala Harris, that she's the new Willie Horton. They're going to use these kinds of ads. You're going to see more of this vice president than any vice president, I predict, in any political campaign for the White House ever. There are going to be all kinds of ads with Kamala Harris in them, and the point of these ads is going to is to Willie Hortonize her, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah, so basically to capitalize off of people's, I guess, distaste for her, whether it's rooted in something, let's say, legitimate, again, maybe these criminal justice critiques, or whether it's rooted in something illegitimate like racism.
Well, not even just distaste, but fear that if he doesn't survive, if he dies in this second term, that she becomes the president.
I guess my hesitation of calling it fear is that, I mean, the Willie Horton ad, the idea was there was someone that you were a threatening, kind of a violent image of a black man whose skin they made darker, famously right on the magazine cover. Like, that was the idea, to really stoke kind of fear of bodily harm almost in the public if Democrats were ascendant. And in this case, it doesn't feel so much like there's a fear of Kamala Harris or what policy she might enact. I'm not even sure what those might necessarily be perceived to be, because for whatever reason, she hasn't been granted or hasn't claimed a substantial identity for herself separate and apart from Joe Biden's. There was the effort to try to make her the czar of the border crisis, but as that has turned south, I don't think either Kamala Harris or the Biden, like, no one has any interest in having ownership over that particular issue. But I take your point that, you know, to this extent, she in some crowds is even less popular than Joe Biden, or at least in some ways easier to parody, that they're going to exploit that. And I think that's right. I think that you should expect that. My hesitation is only that Biden has so much of his own baggage, with polls showing how many of his own voters in the Democratic base have concerns about his health and age and longevity. And even in the core of the ad that you played, most of the critique is about Biden and his age and his physical fitness, as opposed to Kamala's laugh that comes in here at the end, that it really is hard to disentangle how much of this is really about kind of Kamala Harris being Willie Horton, as it were, and how much there's just a lot of dirt on these Democratic candidates that they are susceptible to, right? And that stuff, even if it's small potatoes, like obviously the VP having an awkward laugh, being kind of goofy, whatever. I'm goofy. There's a lot of goofy people. It's not a crime to be goofy. but it starts to add up when there's nothing on the plus side or very little on the plus side of the balance sheet, right? So if you're an incumbent and people perceive you to be responsible for their decline in quality of life while you were president, if people find themselves still struggling to pay for their kids' education, Biden ended the student debt moratorium that started during the pandemic under Donald Trump, adding hundreds or thousands of dollars to people's monthly bills. If there are economic trends that just aren't really about Biden, I'm not even saying it's entirely his fault, but quality of life has been harder and harder for my generation, millennials, and people coming up after me, then he has to put something positive on the balance sheet, or else, yeah, people are going to talk about Kamala Harris being goofy and him being old.
Nope, I take your point. Our remaining moments with Brianna Joy Gray. Slow down, Tavis. When we come forward.
Seeking the truth. Speaking the truth. This is the Tavis Smiley Show. Let's get back to more of this rich dialogue with Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley and Brianna Joy Gray. Brianna, got just 3 minutes left here. Let me ask you how you're tracking the young vote this time out, and what say you about all these articles that I read every other day about the black vote this time around?
Neither is looking good. What was the stat? The Hill reported a couple of weeks ago that fewer than 40% of young black voters say they will vote at all this year. This was, I think, the first poll that showed that Trump was ahead of Biden with the youngest voting tranche, which is pretty remarkable. And black voters are also in the balance in a way that they haven't been historically. I mean, it's been inching in this direction, but Trump has demonstrated repeatedly that he has the ability to have greater inroads into black and Latino voters than any Republican in generations. And I think the Democratic Party needs to think long and hard about why that reason is. With respect to young voters and black voters, I think the issue of Gaza, again, is really central. Polls I've been alluding to show that Democratic voters in general are very much pro-permanent ceasefire, but those numbers spike to almost 100% when you start to talk to young voters and to black voters who feel a lot of solidarity, generally speaking, with Palestinians. I don't know what to make of it. I mean, we know what to make of it, right? The question is what Joe Biden is willing to do about it, and he just came out with some new student debt policy today, possibly trying to shore up support among young voters in particular. But again, that policy geared toward 4 million voters, it's not nothing. Yeah. I think that matters for those 4 million people. That's a far cry from the 44 million student debtors whom he promised at least $10,000 of student debt cancellation.
In the 90 seconds I have left here, I'll give it all to you. What have you learned, or how have you navigated this terrain, this tricky terrain that you find yourself trying to work your way through? Expressing and espousing a different viewpoint that at times gets you reviled by Democrats?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. When the Bernie campaign ended, I had, mainstream journalists, people at MSNBC tweeting, "She'll never work in this town again." And I think that's right. You don't work for an insurgent candidate. You don't ally yourself with people like Cornel West or Bernie Sanders or Jill Stein and get a job in Washington. You don't get your own show on MSNBC like so many press secretaries of yore have gotten. But I didn't enter this business for personal financial gain or personal career advancement. I joined like the Bernie crew in 2016 as a Twitter warrior because I really believed in what he stood for. And even if Bernie himself doesn't speak to some of those projects in the way that I still wish he would, I still believe in them. It's a core value issue. So it is what it is. We have to fight harder than establishment folks have to fight for what they believe in. But we've got numbers and we've got people with us, and so I feel gratified in that.
Her name is Brianna Joy Gray. She's the host of the Bad Faith Podcast, co-host of At Rising the Hill, former national press secretary, as she mentioned, for Bernie Sanders in 2020, former senior politics editor at The Intercept, and I always enjoy talking to her. I had an old man tell me years ago, Brianna Joy Gray, "Tavis, you my horse. If you don't never win a race, you my horse." And so that, I'm not saying that to you. I'm just saying I'm with you come hell or high water. Brianna Joy Gray, good to have you on. All the best to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Our 3 hours gone just like that. Back here tomorrow, Lord willing, to do it all over again. Until then, thanks for tuning in to Tavis Smiley. And as always, keep the faith.